Before we begin, we want to acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. We pay our respect to elders past and present and extend that respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today. This podcast was made mainly on Wurundjeri and Gadigal land, but with interviews from people around the country. I don't know about you, but there's a moment that happens for me pretty much every day that I'm in Australia. I ask myself, do I belong here? Like, actually belong in this country? And what does it mean to be a part of this country? The questions run deep. I think back to my childhood. I was born in the 1980s. My mum's Indian and my dad was from the UK. And I'm the first generation to be born in Australia. My parents were an odd couple. My dad was a 6'3" British soldier. A working class kid who made his way up the ranks, a white guy. My mum is a 5'3", sari clad, Chanel No. 5 wearing socialite from New Delhi. But I was born here, in Sydney, in 1980. Growing up in the 80s, I went to school in the northern suburbs of Sydney, and there just weren't many migrants around, and certainly no Indians, or very few. My brother and I were pretty much the only two brown kids in school, a Church of England private school where they made us wear ties and boater hats. There were two other Indians I can remember, pigtailed twins with big smiles. I think their parents were doctors. And you look on TV, and again, just nobody looked like me, like us. Remember that Qantas ad? The one where they sing, "I Still Call Australia Home"? I remember hearing that and seeing all the cute kids, most of them white, singing against what was then called Ayers Rock, and thinking, none of them look like me. So, should I still call Australia home? Did I ever? Who gets that right? Still call Australia home. Or there was stuff like Paul Hogan.
You look like you need a holiday. A fair dinkum holiday.
All blonde hair and chiselled cheeks. Felt like he was on TV all the time.
Now, there's a few things I got to warn you about, firstly.
He was selling a version of Australia that was a little unrecognisable to me.
Of course, you'll have to get used to some of the local customs, like getting a suntan in a restaurant, playing football without a helmet, and calling everyone mate. Thanks, mate.
She's right, mate.
Apart from that, no worries.
In this Australia, bikini-clad women just wander up to you on the beach and say,
"G'day, Paul.
G'day, love. Of course, you'll have to get used to..."
Well, there he was again, Paul wearing a weathered Akubra hat, swapping knowing winks with other middle-aged white guys at bars.
You see, Australia is the world's biggest island.
All crisscrossing the country, telling foreigners how homogenous we are.
And as you can appreciate, the accent varies noticeably from one place to another. For instance, down south in historic Hobart, you'll find they greet you like this.
G'day.
Whereas on the west coast, you can detect the Mediterranean influence.
G'day.
Of course, in sun-drenched Queensland, you'll come across the more tropical greeting.
G'day.
You get the idea. Anyway, I would watch all this and I would think, is that what I'm supposed to look or sound like? Is that how people are going to say g'day to me when I'm older? Or those VB ads. Dusty working men who've worked up a thirst, herding cattle and revving ATVs.
You can get it riding, you can get it sliding.
Would I ever earn that sort of a thirst? A hard-earned Aussie thirst?
A hard-earned thirst needs a big cold beer.
Admittedly, some of these are just questions of representation. I was a little brown kid in a predominantly white suburb in a predominantly white country. So perhaps little wonder I didn't see myself reflected on TV or in ads, or see many other folks like me walking down the street. But these things that other Aussies were getting...
You can get it walking, you can get it talking, you can get it working a plough.
Maybe I just didn't get it.
Matter of fact, I got it now.
The reasons for asking these questions are complicated, not just for me, but for lots of us. I know some of this is familiar to you. Belonging, identity. It's complex, no matter what your background is. We've all got to work out how we fit into our nation's story, and that's especially true in a country that seems pretty happy to rest on its laurels with this.
I'll slip an extra shrimp on the barbie for you.
As our de facto national motto. All the more so because Australia is often touted, especially by politicians, as being
the most successful multicultural immigration country on the planet.
Former Prime Minister Scott Morrison there. On some level, he's kind of right. We are a successful multicultural country, at least on paper. More than half of us have parents born overseas. We're clearly a nation of migrants, at least today. And that fact alone probably qualifies us as being quote-unquote multicultural. And while we come from a lot of places, for the most part, we all get on and get by. So Australia's multiculturalism clearly has something going for it. But there's no hiding it. We're also racist. Plenty of examples of that.
Every time I got the ball, they booed. Every time I kicked the goal, they booed.
Whether it's booing Aboriginal football players.
Suddenly, it wasn't just Adam Goods the footballer. He was Adam Goods the angry Aborigine.
Or attacking the Chinese during COVID.
At a time of celebration and pride, Chinese Australians are being targeted. Discrimination relating to the coronavirus is fueling an increase in reports of abuse.
Or talking about African Australians like they are all gang members.
And now there's a new threat to public safety.
Trying carjackings, muggings and robberies. These violent crimes are the signature of Melbourne's Apex gang.
Or vilifying refugees.
We will decide who comes to this country and the circumstances in which they come.
I don't want in Australia people who would throw their own children into the sea. I don't.
Or, of course, parliamentarians like...
We now have a situation where a type of reverse racism is applied to mainstream Australians by those who promote political correctness and those who control the various taxpayer-funded industries that flourish in our society, serving Aboriginals, multiculturalists, and a host of other minority groups.
Somehow Australia does multiculturalism well, but we also do racism pretty well. And this podcast is about that contradiction, and particularly how we got here and where do we go.
I don't know about it being successfully multicultural when we have so much racism.
When we think of what or who is Australian, it remains a predominantly white image.
Have we really moved away from all the legacies of white Australia policy? I think the jury is still out. Even today, the jury is still out.
The ones in power are white Australians. The dominant ideology in this country will always be white Australians. I feel like anyone who dares to question that is a very brave person.
These issues about race, I feel Australia cannot escape, and we will continue to keep experiencing these schisms as a people until there is open and honest discussion and reflection about how we can move forward as a nation together.
On the question of how we got here, there are some strange twists and turns. From the early days of the White Australia policy.
We must aim to prevent any alien or servile races from so occupying large territories in Australia as to mix and interfuse not merely among themselves, but with our own people.
To the shameful history of blackbirding.
I've got my grandfather's story. That's enough to justify the use of the word slavery, because he's a 12-year-old child brought here and put on farms and abused continually.
From the weird marketing of Australia as a white man's paradise.
Let us hope that immigration of the future will be planned deliberately and intelligently and offer more opportunities to the people of our own stock.
To the waves of immigrants and refugees who finally put the multi in multiculturalism and Australia's growing pains as it came to terms with its new sense of self.
Hordes of angry youths have been tearing around Cronulla all day looking for a fight.
This podcast is a potted history of how we stopped being white Australia and became, well, what we are today. You're listening to Australia Fair from SBS. My name is Janak Rogers. I'm originally a journalist, and these days I teach journalism at RMIT University in Melbourne. I care a lot about media diversity, and this podcast is partly my way of leaning into the questions of what stories we tell about ourselves and who gets to tell those stories. You'll be hearing from all sorts of people in this podcast, but they all share one thing in common. the immigrant or migrant experience. We're all somehow Australians, but also from elsewhere. And whether you see Australia as the world's most successful multicultural country, or as a racist backwater, it's fair to say a lot has happened since Federation back in 1901, and we'll get into the nitty-gritty of that in a second. But this story, like all Australian stories, starts with who is here first.
The colonial policy leading up to the Federation of Australia, initially it was thought by British authorities that Aboriginal people could be wiped out, and there were substantial efforts to do so, either through military instruction or by arming landholders to undertake indiscriminate killing of Aboriginal people.
Jackie Katona is a Jok woman from the Kakadu area of the Northern Territory. She's arguably best known for leading the campaign to stop the Jabiluka mine in the Northern Territory.
My mother was removed as a child from her family under previous government protection policies, and I grew up in the southern states of Australia. I've been an activist for as long as I've been able to question things around me, and that's become particularly important growing up in Australia as an Aboriginal person, challenging the dominant ideas about what Australia is.
As an environmental activist, Jackie won the prestigious Goldman Prize along with mirror woman Yvonne Margula. And she's worked for the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody, the Stolen Generations Northern Territory, and others.
The issues experienced by the multicultural community in Australia are similar to that experienced by Aboriginal people, because issues around difference are treated in a unique way in Australia. But the connection to land, the prior ownership by Aboriginal people, puts Aboriginal people as a central part in the identity of Australia.
The White Australia policy was about immigration, about who gets to come to Australia. But it was deeply entwined with the broader colonial project and the desire to subjugate and eventually breed First Nations people out of existence.
These laws were supported by a pseudoscience known as eugenics, which called for racial purity. And this fed into the psyche of who Australia is today. And eugenics determined that children of mixed race heritage should be destined in life to be subordinate employees, either on large cattle stations or as domestics. And my mother was drawn into that system because of her mixed race heritage.
Jackie's story, though, is also one of immigration and mixed identity. Her mum was working on the Snowy Mountains Authority, where she met...
She met my father, a migrant from Hungary. He was a refugee from the 56 Revolution.
And like all immigrants here, he had a complex relationship with Australia.
Because of my father's experience as a migrant, he had several very negative experiences where he felt absolute rejection socially and personally. And it was his view that migrants would be treated as second-class citizens. His level of education wasn't recognised in Australia. His technical working skills weren't recognised in Australia.
Jackie was born into a division that runs deep in Australian society between those who were here and those who came.
When I was born prior to the 67 referendum. So the nature of my citizenship wasn't necessarily equal with other Australians. The nature of my father's citizenship wasn't necessarily equal with other Australians as well. And we keenly felt the vulnerability of that.
Green Senator and Indigenous activist Lydia Thorpe has caused a stir in the Federal Senate this morning by mockingly reciting the Oath of Allegiance.
Thorpe, please recite the affirmation on the card.
I will be faithful and I bear true allegiance
to the colonising Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II.
Senator Thorpe, you are required to recite...
Lydia Thorpe is a jab-warring Gudai Gundich Mara woman. She's a human rights, climate and forest activist and currently an independent senator for Victoria in the federal parliament. At Lydia's swearing-in to the federal senate, she caused something of a stir, walking up with a raised fist, clearly defiant and uncomfortable about the words she had to say.
Order.
I, Lydia Thorpe, do solemnly and sincerely affirm and declare.
So as I was walking with my fist up, I was thinking, okay, what do I do? What do I do? I had all the strength of my old people and all the struggles that we've endured. That's what I felt in my heart and soul when I walked up to that bench. And that's what you feel in this place a lot, because you're participating in a system that tried to wipe your people out.
There's that famous William Faulkner quote that comes to mind, "The past is not dead, it's not even past." It's clearly true for many Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, but also true for those of us who are immigrants here. Lydia's work is also trying to bridge that gap.
You know, our connection with multicultural families and people seeking asylum particularly have so much in common that, you know, I think as good allies, Australia is looked at being, you know, such a lucky country and such a great country, but you scratch the surface and you see how racist this country is.
Aboriginal people in Australian society, after successive waves of migration to build the economy of Australia, yet again Aboriginal people are always left isolated and alienated from large-scale economic participation and never enjoy the wealth of mainstream Australia.
This podcast is mainly focused on the immigrant story, but we want to acknowledge clearly that Australia was built on the stolen lands of the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, and that the racist policies and beliefs at the heart of colonialism were first and foremost directed at them. This always was, and always will be, Aboriginal land. With that in mind, it's time to take things back a little bit and take a close look at the early days of Australian Federation and how we got started with what came to be known as the White Australia Policy. So it's 1901, Australia's population is about 4 million at this point, and Australia's first federal parliament is sitting in Melbourne. Picture a bunch of dudes in tight waistcoats and oversized moustaches packed into Melbourne's exhibition building.
I do not think either that the doctrine of the equality of man was really ever intended to include racial equality.
Prime Minister Edmund Barton was Australia's first Prime Minister. And here's what he said when he was introducing the Immigration Restriction Bill to the House of Representatives on the 7th of August 1901.
There is no racial equality. There is basic inequality. These races are, in comparison with white races, I think no one wants convincing of this fact, unequal and inferior.
If you have any doubt about the deep roots of racism in Australia, sit back and enjoy this.
The doctrine of the equality of man was never intended to apply to the equality of the Englishman and the Chinaman. There is deep-set difference, and we see no prospect and no promise of its ever being effaced. Nothing in this world can put these two races upon an equality. Nothing we can do by cultivation, by refinement, or by anything else will make some races equal to others.
Again, that's our first Prime Minister introducing his first big piece of legislation in our first Parliament. The policy became known as the White Australia Policy, and it had one clear aim: keep Australia for white people.
Interestingly, the Immigration Restriction Act of 1901 was actually a coalescing of immigration-related legislation in each of the colonies.
Abul Rizvi is the former Deputy Secretary of the Department of Immigration and a self-confessed immigration nerd.
Victoria, Western Australia, Queensland, etc., all had various pieces of legislation that sought to restrict the entry of non-Europeans into the country. And in particular, it was about the Chinese.
The White Australia policy, though, wasn't just driven by racism, but also economics.
It was about restricting the entry of Chinese people, initially restricting the entry of Chinese people to work on the gold fields, including in the 1890 gold rush in Western Australia. So the Immigration Restriction Act at that time was actually quite uncontroversial because it just coalesced existing policies and legislation of all the colonies.
We'll look more at the run-up to 1901 in the next episode. For now, it's enough to know that race and economics drove the White Australia policy. The whole debate in Parliament centred on what was more important, to keep out Asians and other people of colour because they stole white people's jobs, or simply because they were racially inferior. Pick your poison, basically. Back in 1901, one politician, William McMillan, talked about his desire
to prevent any alien or servile races from so occupying large territories in Australia as to mix and interfuse, not merely among themselves, but with our own people.
The leader of the Australian Labor Party, a guy called John Christian Watson, added his two cents.
The objection I have to the mixing of these coloured people with the white people of Australia lies in the main in the possibility and probability of racial contamination. The racial aspect of the question to restrict migration to Australia, in my opinion, is the larger and more important one.
The problem for Australia's founders was, how do you keep Australia white without being explicitly racist? Australia was part of the Commonwealth after all, and Britain had a real interest in keeping the peace among its colonies and former colonies. And quite obviously, we have some large and powerful Asian neighbours, so being openly racist wasn't seen as a great idea. Yet, Australia managed to find a way.
The legislation never actually refers to white Australia. Yet, if you look at the language used around it at the time, the public language, the political language, there was no problems in the Australian community to referring to it as the White Australia policy. People were quite comfortable about it.
I'm curious, at that time, so race, eugenics and just the colonial projects were still quite alive at the time. We can sort of look back from our vantage point now and go, that's truly shocking, some of the language and some of the value set that was active. How much of an outlier was Australia looking to similar countries, I guess, who they were English-speaking, largely Anglo-Saxon? Were we just doing what everybody else did, or were we outliers of some sort?
Frankly, in 1901, we weren't that different to countries like Canada, the United States, New Zealand, and indeed many countries in Europe. They too had various methods of restricting the entry of non-Europeans. And the real difference, I think, in the way Australia went about it was the language we used. Actually referring to it as the White Australia policy was probably not all that clever. But it was the nature of Australians. We tended to call a spade, whereas other countries were a little more sophisticated in the way they talked of their respective policies, although their policies achieved the same objective and were about the same thing.
On paper, though, we went with the more innocuous-sounding Immigration Restriction Act, and we cooked up a device. Enter the dictation test. All non-Europeans had to pass a dictation test of 50 words. Sounds easy enough. But the catch was it could be in any European language. Here's one example in English, pushing a weird mix of inner reflection and counter-revolutionary defeatism.
The need for mental stillness, for quiet and balance, is obvious. People are too excited. Let us think how null and void our little revolutionary efforts are when tested by reality. Yet, the fruitful results in our private lives and public efforts spring almost always from quiet reflection and mature contemplation.
Here's another one about tigers.
The tiger is shorter in the leg than the lion, but he is longer in the body.
Or another fascinating one about eels.
As nobody had ever been able to discover the actual history of the eel, people sought a miraculous explanation.
Now imagine that being given to you as a dictation test in any European language. Pretty hard to do. The dictation test was, in effect, something of a masterstroke. It allowed Australia to discriminate on the basis of race without openly using the word race. And it saved the early federal parliament from antagonising its close relationship with the UK. But above all, it did the job of keeping out the alien, servile, inferior races.
The dictation test in particular, that was used to exclude non-Europeans from entering and settling in Australia. So when we talk about there being an indelible imprint of race on the national identity, we're talking about that.
Tim Suthpamasane is a former race discrimination commissioner and a leading voice on multiculturalism in Australia.
Australian, it remains a predominantly white image. Think about which faces in Australian media. Think of which iconic pictures are used to describe our sunburnt country. Think of the images around the surf or the beach, the sun and sand. Think of Max Dupain's Sunbaker picture. Think of icons like Chesty Bond. These are the sorts of images that we are referring to when we talk about the long tail of the white Australia ideal. And it does have an effect in signalling who is Australian, not just historically, but who might be most authentically or really Australian.
But the White Australia policy wasn't just about keeping non-white people out, but also about getting more white people in.
750,000 immigrants like these have gone there from Britain since the war. They will find a country huge, sprawling, and extremely short of people.
From Federation onwards, these two imperatives, getting white folks in and keeping coloured folks out, defined Australia for the next seven decades, and arguably beyond. The £10 POM scheme, by the way, is how my dad got here. As a white guy and a former British soldier, he was the perfect kind of immigrant. And it's not lost on me that without my white dad getting a warm welcome in Australia, my brown mother would have never been let in. Jumping ahead a little bit here, it's in 1984 that we adopted our national anthem, Advance Australia Fair. The song dates from the 1870s, though. It was written by a Scottish guy called Peter Dodds McCormick. Most of us don't even know the second verse, let alone the verses that were dropped, including one that's a gushing ode to Cook's arrival and the colonial project.
When gallant Cook from Albion sailed, true British courage bore him on. Till he landed on our shore, then here he raised old England's flag, the standard of the brave. With all her faults, we love her still. Britannia rules the wave.
There's little doubt that when Peter Dodds McCormick wrote Australia Fair, he didn't just mean fair as in just. It's fair as in white. And the song carried that message through 70 years of the White Australia policy, until eventually becoming our national anthem in 1984. Worth remembering, and a bit of a sliding doors moment here, that if we weren't straining joyfully to sing Advance Australia Fair, we almost went with either Waltzing Matilda or the Wurrumpi Band's My Island Home. I know what I'd rather be singing. And my island home, my island home, my island home is waiting for me. But how did we get to the White Australia policy in the first place? In 1901, why was our founding parliament so keen to keep Australia white that it made it basically the first priority of government? Long answer is eugenics, colonialism, etc., etc. But the short answer is because they hated the Chinese who were here.
It's so important to understand the racism that evolved during the Goldfields era because it emerges at various times throughout.
Australia's history yet again and again and again. It's really around the 1880s that you start to see this build-up of supposedly publicly expressed anti-Chinese sentiment.
I looked at all these images and anecdotes, and it got to a point where I realized like everything I was reading was just painted or written by a white man.
Anti-Chinese sentiment led to the biggest race riots in Australia's history, to families being torn apart, and a strain of official racism being wound into the DNA of Australian political life from the very beginning. That's next time on Australia Fair. Follow Australia Fair in the SBS audio app or on your podcast app to get the next episode. And if you want to get in touch, you can email us at australiafair@sbs.com.au. We'd also love to make a bonus episode with your stories and thoughts. So if you want to share any of your experiences or thoughts in a voice message, we'd really love to hear from you. You can email a voice memo to australiafair@sbs.com.au.